Thank you for the introduction. All right, let's get started. So today I wanted to talk a bit about sign structures of frustrated quantum magnets, and specifically how difficult or easy it might be to learn them. So let's see. Yeah, so first of all, let me acknowledge some of my collaborators. So you already had Nikita as a visitor yesterday, and at Radboud University, I typically work with Misha Katznelson and Andrei Bagrov. And for one of the papers, Konstantin Tikhonov was also involved. Let's start with a tiny geography lesson. So what you see here is a map of Europe, and I've highlighted the Netherlands. And what we at Nijmegen are kind of known for is that it's actually the oldest city in the Netherlands. And you might have heard that we had a Nobel Prize kind of awarded to two people at Radboud. And I work at the Theory of Condensed Matter department here. And since we're the only real theoretical physics department at Radboud, we do a whole range of different, we work on a whole range of different topics, including electronic structure calculations, some stuff on quantum antibody theory. And the part that I want to focus on today is complexity theory. That could be kind of summarized in one question: what is complexity? And then that topic can be subdivided into a few kind of subparts. So there's been some work on structural complexity. So if you take a black square, then you would call it simple. Or if you take a Van Gogh painting, you could call it complex and stuff like that. Then Misha's also been working on biological complexity, and specifically how arising from some simple sequences, you get something as complicated as our kind of real world. And the interesting part for us is the complexity and quantum systems. We still believe that everything is kind of related, but for today, let's focus on quantum systems. And for that, let's consider Heisenberg model, Heisenberg anti-ferromagnetic model on three different lattices. So on a square lattice, you would say that the system itself is quite trivial. You can do quantum Monte Carlo calculations to get pretty much any observable you'd like. And then on the right, you see the Kagame lattice, where things are not that trivial. And so far, there aren't really good methods to solve that system. And in the middle, we have the triangular lattice, which is kind of in the middle. So the plan for today. So first of all, as a disclaimer, we'll always stick to simple objects. We'll not consider density matrices or time evolution or anything. Anything fancy, we'll do ground states. And I'll try to argue the following four points. And first of all, is that the ground states of frustrated magnets are actually quite difficult to learn. And second point is that it's the sign structure that's difficult, not the amplitudes. It's only difficult in some formalism. And I'm going to present an alternative formalism to talk about the sign structures. And it turns out that in that formalism, even for the most frustrated systems, the signs or the sign structures aren't that complicated. So let's start with part one. And we'll talk about the generalization properties of neural networks. If we want to solve some spin 1/2 system, we could try to exactly diagonalize it, right? So we could go to 48 or 50 spins if we are pushing the state of the art. But if you want to consider anything anything bigger, then you start running out of memory. So you can't memorize or remember everything. So what we'll have to do instead is we'll try to learn it, right? And you probably know that neural networks are quite good at learning, not grand day specifically, but pictures, video, audio, whatever else you'd like. So we'll try to play around with neural networks a bit. So we'll start with something very simple. So if you have this data set of handwritten digits, then you can train your neural network on that and then feed a digit or a picture of that digit into a neural network and ask it what it is, and it will correctly or incorrectly predict something. And we'll try to do the exact same thing, but now with a ground state that we obtained from exact idealization. So for each basis vector, we'll associate some plus or minus sign, for example, depending on whether the associated coefficient is positive or negative. Then we'll feed that basis vector into a neural network and ask it what sign I should put in front of the coefficient. My slides seem to be behaving a little bit slow. Okay. So about Hamiltonian. So actually I would like to talk about the simplest possible Hamiltonian that we could have and that's the Ising model in transverse field. But unfortunately I work at the kind of theoretical physics and material science department, so I have to take a rather realistic model, which in our case will be the Heisenberg model. And another addition that we'll do is that we'll consider two types of bonds and two couplings, J1 and J2. And by kind of choosing the bonds correctly and tuning J2 over J1, we can consider frustrated and non-frustrated regimes. Okay, so there are a few systems that we can play around with. So for the J1, J2 model on the square lattice, on the right, I have some very pictorial kind of plots for the phase diagram. It's not very accurate, but the important thing for us is that below, for example, 0.4 and above 0.6, we have some type of Neil ordering. That the ordering is different, but it's still a rather simple ordering. And for the triangular lattice, it's a similar story. So below some value around 1 or 1.25, we have this Neil ordering, and then at some point we get the quantum spin like it. And for the Gagame lattice, same story again. Okay, what we'll do now is we'll take a 24-site Kagame lattice, a rather small system, and we'll train our neural network on 1% of the Hilbert space, and we'll test it on the 99%, so on everything else. Compare this to the standard 80-20 split that you would do, for example, for MNIST or something. And what I'm showing here is the overlap that you get on the test data set. And actually, I have two problems here. One is the binary classification problem when I ask my neural network to predict the signs. And the second is the regression problem when I ask it to predict the amplitudes, or more specifically, the logarithms of the amplitudes. And it looks like predicting signs is much more difficult for the neural network. And this seems to be a consistent picture between different models, and based on that, I will kind of assume that signs are more difficult and focus on them from now on. And so let's now go back to all three systems and analyze how well the neural networks can learn the sign structures. So again, plotting overlap on the test data set, we're again using 1% for the training and 99% of the Hilbert space for the testing. And what we see here is that there is some correlation between the frustrated regimes and the quality of our learning. So for the square lattice and for the Kagame lattice, this correlation is actually pretty good. So we can basically pinpoint the phase transition points. For the triangular lattice, it's slightly different. But for example, for the J2 over J1 equal to 1, what we know is there is this 120 degree ordering, which might be kind of tricky for the neural network to learn. Okay. So what we've done so far is that we've kind of shown that signs are more difficult to learn and that this difficulty is correlated with frustration. And this was our prediction. And now if you try to run real variational Monte Carlo simulations, it turns out that kind of the results resemble the results from supervised learning pretty well. So on the bottom here, I'm now showing the overlap that you get from running a full variational Monte Carlo simulation. So we're using stochastic reconfiguration in a two-layer dense network. And indeed, you get high accuracy in the non-frustrated phases and lower overlap in the frustrated region. There's actually it's quite surprising how well this prediction actually works. So I'm now showing a few of the relatively recent papers. For example, for the J1, J2 model on the square lattice, in this work, Nomura and Imada obtained less than 1/100th of a percent relative error in energy, which is quite amazing. And then just a few weeks probably ago, Christopher Roth uploaded a preprint where they get 0.05% relative error for the triangular lattice, also in the quantum spin liquid phase, which is again pretty good and corresponds to our predictions where the convolutional networks weren't really struggling with predicting these times. However, for the Kagame lattice, the situation is quite different. So many papers just ignore it when they propose new methods and kind of test everything on transverse field easing model. But in papers that do actually show results for the Kagame lattice, you see that the error is somewhere around 1 or 2%, and the overlap isn't really that high. So then the question is, what do we do with the Kagame lattice? And the kind of a half-joking answer is to stop using neural networks and to use something like MBMC, which actually produces decent results. And for a more serious answer, let's talk about the second two statements from. The second two statements that I want to argue. So in this preprint, we are introducing a new formalism, or a way to think about the sign structures and how difficult or easy they are. And it turns out that they aren't that difficult, even for the Kagame lattice. Okay, let's see how it works. So we start. Let's start on the top left. Let's start with a real lattice. So suppose I have four localized spin 1/2 articles. Then for example, they have again Heisenberg interaction, then I know that the ground state is in the sector of zero magnetization. So my Hilbert space is going to contain four basis states, and I'm showing them here. Right? Then in this space, I can connect basis states using matrix elements of my quantum Hamiltonian, and I can also associate weights to the edges, and specifically just take the matrix elements. Okay, so I now have a weighted graph, which is in size kind of exponential in the system size, and it contains pretty much all the information I need to solve the system. And so suppose that I now somehow magically know a wave function. What I can do is I can attach this wave function onto nodes of the graph. So each node is going to get an attribute, which is just a coefficient of the wave function. Okay. If we now focus on time reversal symmetric Hamiltonians and assume everything is real, we can split the wave function into the amplitude and sine part. And once we do that, what we can do is we can kind of shift the information about the amplitudes from the nodes onto the edges. So instead of having the product of an amplitude and sine on the nodes, what I'm going to do is I'm going to multiply the amplitudes with the matrix elements and take this as my new weight of the graph, of the edge, sorry. And then on the nodes, I have the signs left. And what it means is that now I have a general graph with binary variables and nodes and some real numbers as edges. And what that defines is that defines an easy model. In case if you don't want to assume that that your Hamiltonian is time reversal symmetric and want to deal with complex variables, kind of most of the stuff of the formalism still applies, except that you get an XY model instead of the Asian model. Okay, let's do the exact same transformation, but slightly more formally now. So again, on the left, I have my real lattice and the Hilbert space and the resulting easing model. And I expand my wave function as in the basis, for example, for these E matrices. And I split the H coefficient into sine and amplitude. Then I think I calculate the expectation value of the Hamiltonian, and slightly rearrange the terms. I obtain the easing model where the coupling Jij is given by the product of the quantum matrix elements times the amplitudes. Now I can phrase my variational Monte Carlo or actually variational method as a simple combinatorial optimization on this graph if I somehow know the amplitudes. Okay, and if that's now an easing model, we also know everything about easing models, right? We know how, we know whether they're glassy, whether they're not, like difficult, easy, and all that. Let's do a simple test of this new formalism. Let's consider an unfrustrated system, and specifically we'll consider a Heisenberg anti-ferromagnet magnet on the square lattice. And it's well known that the sine structure of the ground state is given by the Marshall sine rule. But if I do the transformation to my auxiliary easing model, it turns out that the model itself is also unfrustrated. So that means that without doing any optimization, actually even without using the amplitudes, I can reconstruct the signs and automatically kind of obtain the Marshall's sine rule. Okay, but what if my system is frustrated now? Then, in principle, the matrix elements of our classical easing model are given in terms of products of some real numbers, and we don't know a priori anything about that. So it kind of it's logical to expect that the system might be glassy and hence and be hard to actually solve. And here are some pictures of how many steps you would actually need in the simulated annealing or quantum annealing, if you quantum simulate annealing, like to obtain some decent accuracy on the energy. And but somewhat unexpected, in our case, the situation is much, much better. So let's consider, for example, this 18-site Kaggle lattice with periodic boundaries. What I can do is I can do exact diagonalization on that small system. Then I can kind of construct the associated easing model and run simulated annealing on the full Hilbert space. So I'm going to be running simulated annealing on almost 50,000 classical spins. What I'm going to do next is I'm going to run the simulation a few times and record how often it actually converges to the right result. And when I say converges to the right result, what I actually mean is that it attains at least 99.5% accuracy. And the reason that it's not taken 100 is that we don't actually know the sign structure that accurately, because even in exact diagonalization, you have a decay of your wave function coefficients. And at some point, those start to reach kind of numerical precision, and you're actually not sure whether there is a plus or a minus sign in front. Okay, so we'll settle on the 99.4%. And the result that we get is actually this orange curve right here. So what that means is that if I, in my simulated annealing, if I do around 10,000 sweeps, I'm always guaranteed to find the right solution on first try. So that's very difficult from what we saw on the previous slide. I mean, I can repeat the exact same experiment for other systems. I can consider now a 16-site Kaggle lattice with open boundaries, or I consider J1, J2 model on the square lattice. And we also pick J2 to be 0.55 of J1, so that you're kind of in one of the most difficult regimes for the variational methods. And all those systems seem to be easy. I mean, you get the results, you get almost perfect results with, let's say, more than 80% chance if you do something like 10,000 sweeps. So what we thought is let's consider an even more difficult system. And what we took as an example is we kind of did an analog of a Sherrington-Kirkpatrick system for quantum models. So typically in Sherrington-Kirkpatrick, you have easing-like interactions, and then the couplings are normally distributed. So they are kind of Gaussian variables with zero mean and unit variance. We do the same, except that our interaction is now Heisenberg, but we still have random couplings and all-to-all interaction. So the curves kind of drop. So we see that the accuracy decreases. But it's still pretty cool that even for the hardest system, if I do something like 10,000 sweeps, I get about 50% accuracy, 50% probability of convergence. What that actually means is that I have 50% probability of not getting the right result. So then if you repeat the simulation, say 20 times something, and this all can be done in parallel, you get 10 to the minus 6 probability of not finding the ground state. So for small systems, kind of we can say that the system is, that the problem is relatively easy solvable. And what that means is that we can conclude that the easing model that we get is not glassy. Now, I think there are two ways to react to that statement. And one would be to say, okay, that's all good, but why is it practical? You're running combinatorial optimization on an exponentially large graph. How is it useful? And the second reaction would be, that's an interesting statement, but where does it come from? Why is that? And so let's first discuss the first reaction, and there's some time left, I might present some results on the second. So one way to think about frustration is to say that you have to consider the system as a whole, or that you can't use divide and conquer approaches to solve it. But I can try to invert that statement and say, if I know that my system is only mildly frustrated, is there then perhaps hope for local optimization? Can I reconstruct my sign structures locally without looking at the full Hilbert space? How would that look like? Let's suppose I now again have my graph where the nodes are kind of representing basis vectors, and the couplings are now products of my quantum Hamiltonian matrix elements times the amplitudes. And now let's select a connected cluster C from the full Hilbert space and ask whether we can run combinatorial optimization on just that cluster. So I can split my original Hamiltonian into three parts. First, the interaction between spins that are within C. Then the last term is the interaction between spins outside of C. And of course, we get a term when some spins from C interact with the spins outside of the cluster. Okay, but if I'm only optimizing spins within the cluster C, then the second term is actually like an external magnetic field for my EZ model. So it seems like I still have my EZ model, except that I now have an external magnetic field. So nothing too serious for any combinatorial optimization algorithm. So would that work in practice? The answer to that question is yes. But yes. And actually there should be a few raised hands by now claiming that we are actually neglecting the environment. And the simplest answer to that question, what to do about the environment? Because I mean, I'm essentially assuming that to obtain spins within the cluster C, I have to know the signs of all the of everything outside of the cluster, which is kind of unrealistic. But what if I now assume that my cluster is actually not interacting with the outside world and just ignore the external magnetic field? So that turns out to not work as expected. But then the natural question is there an intermediate regime? So we know that kind of this optimization work if I take the full Hilbert space into account. We know that it doesn't work if I just take a small cluster. Could I take a kindly slightly bigger system for which the results would be better? And for that, we can construct so-called, what we call Hamiltonian extensions of our cluster. So if we can have our original cluster C, then we can have a look at which kind of nodes have connections with the outside world, and include the connected spins into our new cluster. Let's call it C1, and that's going to be our original cluster extended once. Then we can kind of repeat the procedure iteratively to obtain C2, C3, and infinity extensions, where C infinity will probably be the full Hilbert space. And we know that on the full Hilbert space we can get good results, and on C0 not so much. So what do we obtain on intermediate clusters? Okay, for that we'll need a few test systems, and we'll again pick maximally frustrated ones to make it to make it complicated. So we'll consider the pyrochlore lattice, and specifically we'll take a 32-site pyrochlore lattice, which is the largest one that is kind of amendable to exact visualization without spending too many computational resources. Then we'll also consider a 36-site Kagame lattice, which is slightly bigger and supposed to be more complicated. And finally, we'll also consider a 32-site all-to-all connected model again. Okay. And since we are not expecting perfect kind of solutions, what we'll do is we'll switch from using accuracy to using overlaps, because now we can, what the overlap does is actually kind of weight the correctly or incorrectly predicted signs in some physical manner. So what we'll have is that we'll use the amplitudes from exact visualization, then combine it with our predicted signs to form a variational ansatz on the cluster C. And then we'll take the exact psi to compare against. Yeah, so again, what we're doing is we're taking a small cluster, we're extending it multiple times, then we are running our combinatorial optimization on the big cluster, and in the end we are throwing away everything except the results on the small cluster. The idea is that we assume that the external fields are zero, so it makes sense that you don't want to be close to the boundary to not feel the effect of that, and hence we kind of build the extensions around our cluster to push it as far into the bulk as we can. And so here are the results of that procedure. So for the pyrochlore lattice, we get pretty high overlap. So for the third order extension, we actually have almost a delta function here at one. And what I'm actually showing here is the probability distribution of the overlaps. So kind of on the x-axis you have the overlap, and then what's the probability density on the y-axis. On the bottom you have the raw data or the points that we sampled, and on the top the kind of the estimated density. All right, and then we kind of move towards more and more complicated systems, and we see that instead of like proper delta function at one, we get something which is peaked at some values close to one. But in all the cases, if we consider, I don't know, like second or third order extension, we can basically get to more than 95% overlap, which is quite cool, because we are still running optimization on a system that's much smaller than the Hilbert space. And what that means is that there is indeed potential for local optimization. So what we have is that we've kind of clearly shown that the sign structures aren't glassy in the sense that the auxiliary easing models aren't glassy. And what's cool is that we can run local optimization in polynomial time. So if I assume that M is my initial cluster size and I extend it K times, then the complexity of the full algorithm is going to be M times N to the power K. So if K equal to 3 is sufficient, then basically I get an algorithm which is kind of cubic in my initial system size, much better than exponential. Okay. Reasonable question to ask is whether you can apply the same procedure to run proper variational Monte Carlo simulations. And although I don't have results to show how well it works or doesn't work in practice, I can kind of explain the procedure briefly. So suppose I have a neural network that is able to predict amplitudes, maybe correctly, maybe incorrectly. So initially it will give me some garbage. I can nonetheless sample some basis vectors from it. Based on these basis vectors and my Hamiltonian, I can kind of determine clusters of spins on which I need to compute the signs. Once this is done, I can run my simulated annealing with some cluster extensions and all that to get the signs in the clusters. And this should be sufficient to estimate local energies. Because for the local energies, you only need the relative signs of the wave functions, because you have like a quotient here. Okay, once I have my local energies, I can calculate the expectation value of the Hamiltonian, then take the gradient to get take the gradient with respect to neural network weights and do, for example, stochastic gradient descent or something like that. Then there are like two issues or potential issues to discuss. First of all, is how robust is our optimization algorithm with respect to noise in the amplitudes? So if I start with a neural network with random weights, it's kind of reasonable to assume that it's going to give me random numbers back. And then how likely is it that I'm going to get the correct sign structure back? And the second is that since we're currently, if we have to do the third order extension, then it can be a bit computationally expensive. And to make it practical, it might be good to improve the algorithm for building the clusters. Okay. And now there's a big disclaimer that the following part is unpublished data. So I think it's correct, but please take it with a grain of salt. And this data will hopefully also answer the gray but why part, namely, why do we see that the simulation annealing algorithm actually works that well? Okay, so let's start by discussing the effect of noise on the amplitudes. So if I have my neural network predicting the logarithms of psi, then I can add a uniform random number to that, and epsilon is going to determine how big this number is. And I can see how bad or good my results remain. So here I show the dependence of three quantities on this noise level epsilon. So first we have accuracy, and this is like simply accuracy of how well we predict the sign structure. And it makes sense that if we don't have any noise, we get perfect agreement. And then if we increase the noise pretty high, we get 50% accuracy, meaning just random. Okay, then the overlap part is the overlap as we were discussing it previously, namely our capital OC. So it's the overlap on basically it's the overlap when I take the signs from my simulated annealing. I take my now noisy amplitudes, combine that into a variational kind of prediction, and compare it against the exact ground state. And finally, what I can also do is I can compute the overlap just between amplitudes. So I have my noisy amplitudes and I have my exact amplitudes, and I simply take the dot product between the two. Okay, and the encouraging part here is that it seems that even though the amplitude overlap is decreasing rather fast, our overlap of the with the kind of with our signs is still pretty high. So I mean, we don't get the amplitudes correctly, but we still predict the signs correctly. And that's more clearly illustrated here on the right when I kind of plot the dependence of our kind of sign overlap versus the amplitude overlap. And what we see here is that, for example, if I'm able to get amplitudes with like within 60%, then it's going to result in almost 90% overlap of my signs. And this is great, because what you can actually do is that instead of starting with random weights in the neural network, what we can do is we can do transfer learning. So for example, I could train my neural network on a Kagame 27 or something, and then get the amplitudes there, transfer it onto 36 sites, and this transfer can be done such that the resulting amplitude overlap is above 60%. I just recently ran some simulations for that. And then it seems that this should be sufficient to estimate my signs with more than 90% overlap. Okay, so this is encouraging. And then the second part that you can analyze is the distribution of couplings. So we know that our missing model is just mildly frustrated, but how do you kind of quantify what is mildly frustrated? What you can do is you can put the exact solution onto your graph, and then you can ask how many links or how many couplings are actually frustrated and how many are not. A frustrated coupling actually means that you get a positive energy contribution from that coupling, and a non-frustrated means that the contribution to energy is negative. Then I can take all the kind of the normal and frustrated couplings, sort them, and just plot them. And what I'll find is that it seems that the normal couplings are much higher in magnitude compared with the frustrated couplings. And that might mean that if I throw away some smallest couplings, I'm not actually losing anything in the sense that those are frustrated anyway and don't have to take them into account in my optimization algorithm. And we can take a limit of that procedure in a sense and say, okay, what if now for each spin, let's say I have spin number one, I'm going to consider all the couplings it has with the nearby spins. And I'm going to select the largest one in absolute value. So suppose it's this one that I marked in bold. Then I'm going to repeat the exact same procedure for the second spin. I'm also going to select the largest coupling. It might be the exact same one that it had with one, or it might be a different one. This one is in bold, for example. And then I'm going to throw away everything else. I'm just going to consider the largest couplings. Okay. And once I do that, what you can do is you can calculate the probability that this largest coupling will be frustrated. And if this probability is high, what that means is that I can't throw away everything, because otherwise I will get my results wrong, because I mean, now it's frustrated and I would have predicted it different. But it turns out that this largest coupling is almost never frustrated. And that means that if I throw away the rest of my easing model, I can run some simple greedy optimization on this cluster. So it's going to be much faster than simulated annealing. And here are some estimates, the accuracies and overlaps that you expect. So astonishingly, for example, Kagame 18 model, you don't actually lose anything in the overlap. So if you throw away most of your kind of auxiliary easing model for the signs, you will still say 99.99% overlap. I mean, for other models, the situation is slightly worse, which is to be expected, since we assume that the random all-to-all coupled cluster is more complicated, but the overlap is still above 95%. And I think that with this addition, even if we have to consider kind of third order extensions, it's computationally doable. But that's still remains to be seen. Okay, I'm coming to my summary, and I hope that I've illustrated a few points. So, namely, that we started by claiming that ground states of frustrated magnets are kind of tricky to learn, and then we've discussed that it's the sign that's the root of all evil. And then we kind of talked about seeing models as an alternative formalism. And finally, we've concluded that the resulting easy models are actually simple. So then the question is, are these frustrated magnets difficult or simple? And the answer would be, I don't know at the moment. And thanks for your attention.
Should anyone want to ask questions first? Oh, Roger Malco has a raised hand.
Can you hear me?
Hi, Tom.
I don't say this often, Tom, but your talk blew my mind. I loved it.
Really? Thank you.
When you talked about sign problems being local, you know, and you can do the greedy optimization on them. So one thing, you could translate that into the unitary, in the unitary circuit that unties the sign problem, which is cool. But I think, you know, in the wave function way of thinking about it. But the second thing, which is my question, which is, if you think of a wave function, you think of a double semion. Do you know the double semion model?
No, I'm afraid I don't. Could you kind of...
Okay, so it's just it's equal amplitude superposition of all loop-like wave functions of like the toric code.
Ah, right. Okay.
But, and then somebody remind me, but every one that has an odd number of loops has a minus sign in front of it.
Okay.
So it's proven by Hastings that there's no local like unitary that can untie that sign structure. So I think in your language, it means there's basically no local optimization problem for that case. Which I think keeps it in an exponential complexity class. But I would be super interested if you could learn the sign structure of the double semion model. That's my question.
Yeah, I think the reason why we, or at least I expect that we wouldn't be able to, is that all the amplitudes are the same. And then what you expect to see in the end is you expect to see a frustrated easing model with the exact same couplings and kind of in value, and that's definitely going to be glassy. So I don't expect our kind of optimization algorithm to work that well.
So then, does that intuitively to you make it sound like a global optimization problem that you can't like easily solve?
Yeah, in a sense. So I think we're actually looking for some big test systems where we could kind of test our procedure without running the full VMC loop. And it seems that there's some solvable models on the, I think it's kind of maple leaf lattice or something, which are built by doing the bonds and all that. And what turns out in that model, the sign structure can be kind of computed analytically, and the amplitudes are also all like half the amplitudes are equal to one and half are equal to zero. Mm. And if you consider the system as a whole, like without knowing the amplitudes, the system is going to be frustrated and the easing model is going to be frustrated. But if you include the knowledge about the amplitudes and throw away the part that actually has zero amplitudes, funnily enough, our easing model turns out to be unfrustrated as well, just as for the square Heisenberg model.
Crazy. I almost can't believe it. That's amazing. Okay, then my final question If you had a fermionic system where the sine problem is typically non-local because it's like the imaginary time periodicity or something, right? Would you expect a fermionic sine problem to be local in your sense?
The anti-commutator. I wouldn't dare to say expect, but I wouldn't be surprised if it is, because for the fermionic wave function, I think you still have a decay of your kind of wave function amplitudes.
Yep, probably.
And I think that might kind of introduce some kind of hierarchy of like couplings that you have or don't have to take into account. I think there might be some hope for that. Yeah.
All right. I love it. I heard it here first. Solving the sine problem. Thanks. Great talk.
Thank you.
I have a couple of questions. Does anyone else have a question?
Can you hear me from here?
Yeah.
Great. Yeah. It was very cool. Thank you very much. I was wondering, so if I understand correctly, you're studying the difficulty of the sine problem through this auxiliary Ising model. But can you also can you go the other way? So can you like define couplings of an Ising model that are known to be like very hard to solve and then sort of map it back to a quantum state? And then, can you then say something about the complexity of the quantum states generated by those Ising models? Or does that not make sense?
It's an interesting way. Let's see. So I think you can indeed kind of construct Ising models of varying difficulty. There are known algorithms for that, and that's typically what your task is, simulating annealing and quantum simulating annealing and all that one. But that the tricky part is that on the couplings of the Ising model, you have a product of three terms, namely your kind of matrix element and the quantum model, times the wave function amplitudes on the spins. And if you have a product of three numbers, there's no unique way to kind of reconstruct it back. So I think that the mapping, when we kind of put the weights from the nodes onto the edges, is kind of losing information in some sense. So I'm not sure you can easily revert that.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay, I have some questions about your new stuff, because it addresses a lot of the questions I had after I read your papers. So you talked about, I don't know, maybe you want to go back to the slide with the little cycle about how to use this mapping in EMC.
Yeah, give my computer a few minutes, probably, because it's this is my CPU usage, and it's, for some reason, Zoom is using all my CPU. I'll try to scroll back there.
Basically the question is, you talked about if you have at least a 60% overlap, then it's fine. And of course, when you're doing EMC, you're optimizing these amplitudes, so they're getting better over time, and probably within reason you can get to this point where you have 60% overlap. But the question is, when you're doing this BMC, are you also kind of training signs or like phases in your neural network, or can you just totally separate the probability and the phases in your BMC training process?
Right. Oh, lucky. Okay. I think in principle you can completely separate them. Because if the only thing that I need to compute are the local energies to kind of do the update of my amplitudes, then I can I don't actually have to learn the sine structure. I can kind of reconstruct it on the fly using that optimization. And that what in principle you expect to happen is that initially when you're amplitudes aren't perfect. You're not going to get perfect sign structure back, similar to kind of standard optimization, but kind of your amplitudes keep increasing, and then you get a more accurate prediction for your easing model, and then you expect that to be solved more and more accurately. So the 60% overlap, I'm kind of hoping that this you can actually get from transfer learning. At least that's definitely true for the square lattice, that's easy. And for the Kakame lattice, going from 27 to 36, you can actually get that.
I mean, one thing that just from what I've seen looking at some of these models, it's like you can learn the phases probably and then just like throw them away once you get to this 60% overlap or something. That's kind of what I was thinking, because I just can imagine.
I see.
If you're at this very initial training stage and you have bad amplitudes and then you're getting bad signs, it's kind of like you're just in a bad part of your loss landscape, jumping around from bad part to bad part.
Yeah, so it's kind of, so you could say, let's take, I don't know, Netcat, one of those packages, run that for the Kakame lattice, get some wave function, then throw away the phases and try to run our optimization further. I don't believe that it should work. Or I mean, it would be cool if it would, but I wouldn't expect it to, because I think what typically happens with frustrated systems when you try kind of standard VMC is that you get incorrect wave sign structure, which is kind of normal, but then you start kind of adjusting your amplitudes to lower the energy as much as possible for those signs. And then I think if you then go back to our model, the amplitude that you get will actually kind of will result in an easing model where the kind of sign structure predicted by the neural network will be the optimal one.
I see. Yeah, that makes sense. So you're saying the network will like learn a sign structure and then just be like, we're just gonna keep this, and then you just optimize the amplitudes as much as you can.
Yeah, it's not proven, so don't kind of quote me on that, but I wanna say that the time scales in which you learn amplitudes and phases are kind of different, in the sense that it's faster to adjust amplitudes than it is to adjust phases. And kind of one argument for that would be one of those latest tricks that people do is to kind of initially only train phases, specifically for the frustrated systems, when you can say, okay, I'm gonna forget about my amplitudes, I'm gonna put all of them to one, let's say non-normalized, and then I'm gonna train my network to predict some phases, and then I'm gonna turn on the optimization of amplitudes. And I think the reason people actually do that is because, like, once you have something for the phases, it's not that easy to change.
Yeah. Okay, and then my second question, you have a graph that shows, I think this is what it's showing, is it's kind of like the number of these like largest edges in your graph or something. And I know that there was a part in your paper where you talk about how there's usually like a small fraction of large amplitudes in
do you mean kind of graph. this part or the next one?
Yeah, this is what I was thinking of.
Okay.
So I just was curious because my understanding is, you know, a lot of the ground states of frustrated systems are quantum spin liquids, which my understanding of quantum spin liquids is like a pretty huge superposition of a lot of very similar states. And so in that language, I would think that it's not, you can't say that there's kind of a small fraction of large amplitudes, but then I don't know if I'm just thinking of that on like a different kind of magnitude scale where relative to the Hilbert space, it's still a small fraction? Or yeah, which was
I think I actually agree with you. I have a similar picture in my mind. So I've kind of actually like this one partially supports that claim, because you see that the initial decay is kind of linear in this scale. So it's like, since it's log log, it means that it's a power law decay rather than an exponential decay. But the cool part is once you take a specific spin and consider the distribution of couplings with the rest, that might decay exponentially.
I see.
Or super exponentially. So if I just focus on spin one and then consider what the kind of the couplings here are with the neighboring spins, I think what we find is that somehow they decay so fast that it's sufficient to just take one of the bonds. But I don't think that you can kind of conclude from this that kind of the set of all big amplitudes is kind of small or something.
Great. Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Because it's kind of like to get a coupling, you have to take a product of all amplitudes. And then essentially it's sufficient to have one of them small to get a much smaller number.
Yeah. Yeah, when I saw this paper and this mapping, I was like, this is so clever. I don't know. It's just, how many times have people looked at this equation without realizing the mapping? So I think it's super cool.
Yeah, we were actually a bit worried. Like, it looks so simple. Are we sure that nobody wrote about it before us?
Any more questions? All right, let's thank Tom one more time.